Who's recording?
Now I'm recording Scott. Who's recording me?
Me.
Wait, you're recording Scott? I'm recording Scott.
I'm recording Scott.
Let's all record me.
Let's all record Scott. I'll do the video, but only the red channel.
Hello, welcome to Brought to the Table, a podcast brought to you by Scott and Scott and Scott, hosted by Scott.
Welcome to Scott, everybody.
I think I just broke my glasses.
Hi, and welcome to Brought to the Table. Today we have Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, myself, Carter Van Huss, Caitlin Phillips, and Scott Pruitt. This show, for those of you who may be tuning in for the first time, is a show for this group of friends to come together and share with each other things that they have found interesting over the past week, things that they just really want to talk to their friends about. Today, our two groups are going to be Caitlin and Scott talking about some computer science bullshit, and Ian and Diana talking about, I don't know, actually. Is it Mothman?
Yeah, Mothman.
Okay, talking about Mothman. And I get to do nothing today except for ask a few questions. Because,
like normal.
That's all I ever do. Yes. Today, the way we're going to decide which team goes first is we are going to do trivia questions about alcohol.
Dad, turn the car around.
Wait, please ask me this question so I can be smart.
Yes, you will be the smart. I think this will be a tight competition, actually, between everybody but Scott. Okay.
Sure. Nice.
So the way this is going to work is I'm going to give you a cocktail, and you are going to tell me more or less what goes into it. Okay?
Oh, well, I'm going to lose this one.
Shit. All right, Ian's already won. Good job. All right.
Just do it.
So, cocktail number one. Mojito. Scott, do you actually have an answer?
I do have an answer.
Is it an answer you think is going to be right?
I know part of it will be correct.
Okay, well, give me your answer.
I'm pretty sure you put rum.
Correct.
And then two scoops of avocado.
Nope.
Mm-mm. A whole red onion. And then some cheese whiz.
You just described like a taco with a shot of rum next to it. Also, no taco shell. And a terrible taco. Diana, you seem like you have an answer.
I would like to defer to my
teammate. No, that's not how that works. That's not how that works. He did.
Don't you throw me under the bus.
Okay, okay. Mint, mm-hmm. Rum,
yep.
Ice.
Technically, sure.
Lime juice?
You are almost there, and I'll give it to you. Okay. You guys ready? Martini.
Oh, let me answer this.
Ian, come on, I don't know this one.
You can do, like, different types of martini, though. In Gilmore Girls, they had vodka martinis, and...
Well, that's a martini with vodka.
Yeah.
I want to know what a regular, like, the traditional martini is.
I think the normal martini is gin?
And?
It's
not just a shot of gin, probably.
Shot of gin, but
actually
in a different
glass.
It's
just a fancy gin and tonic.
I think vermouth.
That's what you're going for?
Gin and vermouth, yeah.
Does anybody think she's wrong?
I mean, for a classic, that's what it is.
Caitlin, you got that one, so it's 1-1 right now. I have a few more.
Stakes are high.
Oh, my God. Okay.
I have three more. This is a lightning
round. Oh, my God.
It's a lightning round.
Carter.
You guys are not very lightning. This is your fault, not mine. This is easy. These are easy questions. Margarita.
Tequila and lime and orange juice and... That orange shit. Fuck. I made them.
No, you did not. You did not make them. You made one. One
made
singular
one.
Margarita for four people.
It was my birthday. I'm allowed to make you all go to the store
to
with
read
me
recipes incorrectly. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Ian.
Okay. Margarita, it's tequila, triple sec, and lime juice with typically salted rims.
Bingo. Ian gets the square.
Triple sec is what I was looking for.
Triple sec is what you were looking for. All right, so I'm not going to make you guys do the other two. If anybody
Thank
knows off the top of their
God.
Head, Tom Collins?
Nope.
No.
That is, well, it's, you know, just Tom Baudet and Phil Collins.
One Tom and one Collins.
Blend them up, put them together, only make it once. The real answer is gin, lemon juice, club soda. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And the tiebreaker was going to be an old fashioned because it's
whiskey.
Wait, really? I only like those if I'm already drunk.
I'm actively drinking one.
All right.
Okie dokes. All right, that's good enough. Who won? I forgot.
Ian and Diana.
Me and Ian.
Carter, that's why you don't drink when you podcast.
I just started. Both of them.
I was going to say, which one?
All right.
Okay.
Take it away, boys and ghouls.
Okay, so as Carter butchered it on the intro, what we are going to be talking about, Diana and myself, is the sort of similarities that you find across different cultures and, like, societies about their mythologies and, like, the legends and folklore that a lot of these places have. It's something that has been, like, a very big interest of both mine and Diana's for ever,
I guess? Pretty much as long as I can remember.
Yeah, so, I mean, folklore has always been a really important thing in the sense of this is kind of where we get all of our framework of how we see the world before we figure out how the world actually works. You know, kids learn folklore and legends and myths as, like, hey, these stories will help teach you these important lessons. And it's interesting to see how they evolve between cultures or in cultures that are entirely isolated from one another, what lessons they teach. But the thing that's always been an interest of mine and also Diana's is the fact that these cultures develop the same sort of mythologies or the same sort of stories to tell similar tales or traits or experiences. But it almost goes sometimes to a point beyond just coincidence that they're very similar. There are a lot of things that are very, like, almost very specifically similar. I think Diana has, you know, the flood mythology, which if you want to go into that, please.
So one of the really cool things is looking across a lot of legends and folklore and mythology and straight up religion, there is a very common story of an ancient flood. An ancient flood that wipes away all the sinners or all the bad parts or all the bad things in the world and essentially starts it over again. The most obvious of this that probably a lot of people have heard of is Noah and the Ark from the Bible, where a massive flood is sent down and it's all about punishing that sin, am I right? Like, just clean out them bad people.
Amen.
That's like the most common one, but it actually dates back to like the Epic of Gilgamesh, where a man called, and excuse me on this, Utnapishtim, is told by the god Ea that he needs to actually build a massive boat and survive a flood. It goes to like Norse mythology where Bergilmir, the frost giant, actually survives and repopulates the frost giant race because of a massive flood. Almost every major religion, folklore, native mythology at some point in their history has a massive cataclysmic deluge or flood story. That usually is just considered an ancient time kind of deal. And one of the coolest bits about this is that scientists around the world have taken a look at this and they've actually lined it up with bits and pieces of geology in certain really old regions of the world that they can kind of get into deep layers of the earth. And there's a running theory among geologists and historians that at one point there actually was a massive flood in the entire world that almost flooded the world. Like, it goes from everywhere from like Norse to Hindu mythology to Chinese mythology, where there was just like the idea of this massive flood. And it's so interesting that it goes in literally spread across the world. Almost all of them have the same story. And so this has actually led a lot of geologists and scientists and historians to work with the running theory that at one point in the earth there was actually a massive flood. And so it's just so cool that you can take stories like this from around the world and actually use it to try and figure out history that we might that might not be written down or found anywhere else.
That's a very good example of just like how these different cultures come to similar sort of themes of stories. You know, with the flood one, like Diana said, you have a very similar story. You know, you have Noah and the Ark, you have the Hindu Manu is warned about a flood and is told to build a boat. You have Ea, who is told to survive the flood. You have all of those. And then, like, you also have things such as, you know, Atlantis is something that everybody knows from, you know, the movie that Disney did. However, like, there's a bunch of different cultures that have some sort of idea of this utopian civilization that was, like, super advanced compared to everything, and then some giant event happened either the gods were angry or they destroyed themselves or something happened that sunk them beneath the ocean. You have this, you know, Plato is the first person that we know of to have said it in most of our works. However, there is a lot of it that is coming from different southern, like South American cultures, where their earliest ancestors claim to be from this island that sunk beneath the waves, that they were escaping. And it was also near the, well, somewhere in the Atlantic or closer to the Antarctic. You have different parts where other cultures just have this thing of like, you go too far, you become too advanced, and you lose what you are and bad stuff happens.
Yeah, it's like the Tower of Babel myth. A lot of cultures have the idea that, kind of similar to Atlantis, at the very least, a tower was built that, like, was shown the hubris of man to the gods.
Yeah, and that's very interesting to just think of these cultures, as we know history, have no way to communicate. Such as, like, how would anybody in Greece communicate to somebody who's in South America? We have no idea. But they still have very, very similar ideas of what this history was. And it's just something really interesting to look into. Another thing that they have a lot in common is monsters. Things that go bump in the night, things that play basketball, things that terrify children to no end. This is something that you can find in almost any sort of cultural mythology, is this sort of other evil entity, something that isn't entirely human, or maybe once was human, but is no longer, something that preys on humanity. One of them that most people would probably think of would be a vampire. And you think of that, you know, Eastern European, Romanian, you know, Dracula, blah, blah, blah sort of deal. But there are vampires found all throughout the world. There are vampires in, you know, places such as Africa. There is the Asanbosam, which is a sort of like tree-dwelling vampire. And then there are the Lugaru, which is a fun one because it's sort of a mixture of a vampire and also like a werewolf as well. And earlier history, the vampire and werewolf were almost the same sort of thing. For the longest time, you had the terminology between the two going back and forth, that if it was a werewolf, it was a vampire. It was a monster that was human, that turned into something else, that ate people and drank blood and turned others into more monsters like it. There wasn't that much of a distinction. But then as sort of the mythology evolves, there become a split between the two, which is where you get a lot of things with like the Lugaru or some of the earlier Indo-European ones have a lot of what humans can become if left alone.
And additionally, like witches as like a class of monster or other is also found in almost every religion, like dating back to classical Athens, Medea, like of written that we know about.
It almost at some point makes you kind of wonder, is like, why are these sort of traits the ones that we have picked up on out of everything that you could look at, that you could make up out of a monster? Why is it that these sort of ones are the ones that we have all across the globe? Why is it that, you know, some places look at this as a really terrifying thing? You have werewolves and, you know, you also have werehyenas in Africa, which was really interesting to me. But then you also have cases such as like the berserkers, which are basically bear shirts. They are humans that would put on a like shirt or cape or basically a bear skin and supposedly take on that trait of a bear being this giant, massive monster that's just like destroying things. And they were like channeling that into them.
You also have like the Selkies who would like wear seal coats and yeah, they would be part human, part seal. But that's from a completely different part of the world than the bear shirts. And so you have this really similar theme of like humans who have this animalistic skin that they draw on those qualities or they become that animal in completely different parts of the world that had little to no verifiable contact.
And it's just one of those things that, like, I've joked about it a lot of, well, maybe these things are real. Who knows? Probably not. At least I hope to God not. But, you know, I think it shows something a little bit deeper about what makes humans human. We have this sort of penchant for anthropomorphizing things, of saying, hey, I feel this way, I see the world this way, and this is how I interact with the world. I'm going to take that and put it onto something else. You know, you see it with dogs nowadays. People put emotions onto their dogs, or they put thought processes onto their pets of like, oh yeah, my animal does this, that, and the other. And the whole joke of, oh, he thinks he's human. Like, it kind of speaks something deeper to what it is to be human, I think, more so than what is actually out there. Were there werewolves, you know, centuries ago? Probably not. Hopefully not. We probably wouldn't be here nowadays if there were. But I think it's a really interesting thing to look into, because this is where religion comes from. It's this sort of building of, we don't know, so we want to know, and we want these stories to make us feel better. And I think one of the biggest things that we don't really know is, or at least one of the biggest things that we didn't really have a good idea about, is where the world came from.
Yeah, that's actually one of my other favorite things, along with the massive flood myth, is that there are creation myths. There are so many different kinds of creation myths, but they have actually been narrowed down to literally five different types. Like, take a moment and really think about how many different cultures and mythologies and groups there are all over the world, and imagine narrowing down all that mythologies and being able to put it into like five different categories. There's like five different categories for how each mythology or religion usually talks about how the world is being built. The first and usually the most popular one is called Ex Nihilo. And that comes from a lot of like the big three religions of like Judaism and Christianity, which is creation from nothing. Like, there was nothing before, and then, kind of like Big Bang style, then there were things. The other one is creation from chaos, which is pretty self-explanatory. It's all about a divine being or something bringing order to a previous world that is filled with not nothing, but with like chaotic energy. There's the idea of like the world parent, where it's like the eternal union between two divine beings, which is usually the sky, which is represented as male, and the earth, which is usually represented as female. And you can kind of see that in Maori myth. Excuse me for all my pronunciations. I'm sure none of them are accurate, but I'll do my best. The other one is kind of emergence, which is the previous world like comes from a womb. And you see that in a lot of like South American and like some sections of Southern Native American. But the one that really got me, because I had honestly never heard of this one, was the Earth Diver myth. And this plays, so far as we know, almost primarily in a lot of Native American mythology, particularly on the coastal regions, which is where an animal goes into the water and finds material like clay and earth to build land. And it's the idea that kind of, interestingly enough, goes back to the, we come from the depths of the ocean. And it's just, it's absolutely wild to me that so many of these myths that are literally the basis of religion and mythology can be so similar to each other. Just literally almost identical in some spaces. Some of them are just really odd, like detailed stories. Like, I'm sure a lot of people know the different... If you've read Percy Jackson, then you definitely know the Greek mythology. You know enough. And so that's just a really cool detailed story that's usually really popular. But what's also going with that is all these Native American tales that, even though they're all on the same continent and they have this same kind of underlying theme, they all have different variations on it. And then you take all this and you think about the fact that, hey, we evolved from beings that came out of the water. We evolved from creatures that came out of the water. Like, the Big Bang happened literally something into nothingness. And you get the weird sense that even though a lot of these are like working just with what we know and like our small narrow view from like ancient times, some of them are just so on the nose accurate. And some of them are just so similar. And it's just mind-boggling to me to think that all of these myths and legends can not only be similar to what we can scientifically verify today, but also they are so similar to each other.
Building off of like what Diana was saying about how they have all these different creation myths, there's also a lot of interesting parts within the religions themselves that are just beyond the creation. There are, you know, the sort of idea of like these dead gods that they die for different reasons, typically for, you know, people just being shits because that's what we do.
People are the worst.
So bad.
Fun fact.
Yeah, I know y'all. So,
but yeah, but like that's the thing is like you have these gods that come into like being and then essentially die for us. You know, most people automatically are like, oh hey, we're recording this, you know, 5 days after, well, 4 days after Easter, so clearly we're talking about Jesus. Jesus is one of those gods that we have, but there's also Osiris, there's also Mithras, and then also Dionysus, which I did not know Dionysus was one of these sort of resurrecting gods, but that's just a thing. Like, you have these similar stories. You have Jesus, which is more of the Middle Eastern area. You have Mithras that was in the same area, but I think maybe 1,000 or so or 100 or so beforehand. You have Osiris, which is Egypt, Dionysus, Mediterranean, and I'm sure if you look in, you know, more of the Asian belief systems, such as Hinduism or any of the
Siddhartha, like, Defo, if we're looking in the Indian region, I'm pretty sure I have my names right in that it's Siddhartha.
Yeah, Siddhartha, you know, and then like the idea of the Buddha being this sort of entity that is reincarnated so often, like, it's interesting to see where a lot of, like, you know, the big three of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam have this whole, this entire thing is just a line. Like, all history is entirely linear. But then you have these parts in them where they're like, okay, but things come back. And they're cyclical, which is very similar to some of the other religions, such as Mayans or... why am I blanking on a bunch of others that have
this
idea?
It's also like Celtic. Celtic was a very big belief in like circle of nature, the kind of just circle of life kind of deal. Yeah. It's also very popular in African mythology in terms of less of reincarnation, but more in that a cyclical lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's, it's just to me, it's like, I don't know how to really put it in other words other than this is really fucking cool. Because... where does this come from? Is if this isn't something external to us where it's like, oh yes, werewolves, we have seen them before and this is why everybody has mythology of them, then this is something that is inside us, something that is human. And what does that really say about us as people if everybody has this?
Yeah, I think that sums up why Ian and I personally find this like a really cool topic, is that it's really cool to look at where we've been, especially in comparison to where we are now. It certainly says a lot about us as a species on this earth in general. And it's just really cool to have this wonderful bird's eye view and be able to compare and contrast. And I think we're good there.
Cool.
Yep.
You brought up the Monstars at the beginning of it, and you might have covered this, but I've heard a bunch that, like, werewolves and vampires and stuff came from, like, shallowly dug graves, and then dogs or other animals going into those graves and, like, bringing hands and feet and stuff back out.
So, yeah, that could be one interpretation or one source of it. It honestly, like, the whole werewolf or anthropomorphic, like, is it human? Is it animal? Is it both? Could be something similar to just, like, a hangover of like shamanistic or animalistic, not animalistic, but more of like this natural nature spirit where people are dressing up to sort of channel this sort of animal spirit.
Yeah, it's like Hercules wearing the lion cloak. It's like channeling that. And additionally, you're kind of right in the sense of like there was a lot of, especially a lot of Victorian-ish era vampire lore that came from the fact that back in the day, we had really terrible systems for telling when people were dead. And so there are a couple of diseases that make you seem, as far as we know, with no medical equipment, dead. And a lot of times people would wake up and be like, the fuck am I? And so they would wake up in pure terror and panic because they had passed out or they've come out of a coma. And actually, back in the day, they used to have massive houses, like really fancy, nice houses, where you could store the corpse of your relative for a while. God. So, yes. Like, somebody could watch over it just to, like, double check for a few days to make sure they didn't casually wake up. And people would actually pay to store their relatives in fancier and fancier houses. So you can imagine the medical health nightmare.
Yeah.
From like a massive house of dead people just out in the open. Because at the time, the only way to tell if you were dead is if you started to decay. So yeah, like you're right. There is actually, specifically for vampires at least, there's a lot of like mythology and kind of folklore that was developed on the fact that our medical practices were not super sound.
Building off of that, think about what are the traits that most people attribute to vampires. Longer nails, longer teeth, palish skin, and no pulse, all of which are things that a body typically normally does. Your nails have it to where the skin retracts off of them, making them appear longer. The same thing with, you know, your gums and your lips sort of retract a bit more as well, making it seem like you have longer teeth. Your body is naturally going to go more of a paler color as you die. So imagine you just see a body that looks like it's still... it's changed. Like, it hasn't decayed yet, but, like, the muscles and the skin is tightening or the decay is starting to set in internally. It's going to change how it appears outside. And if you have no knowledge of this, it's going to look like that body is doing something that it shouldn't be doing. But then building off of Diana's point of the houses where they store people, the origin of the phrase "Saved by the Bell" came from there because they had a system set up before the houses were built where they would bury people with cords running from the coffins to a bell. And so, like, if the person woke up in the coffin and was like, oh shit, I'm not dead.
Fun fact, not dead.
Yeah. Even though they'll be stone dead in a minute, that they would ring the bell by, like, pulling on the cord. Hence, somebody who is there would come and save them. Hopefully. Probably not.
No, that's all definitely super true. Sorry, I just used to be a big vampire nerd. And I just wanted to talk about, there's one more, which is tuberculosis. It was just super trendy to have tuberculosis. So one, everyone just kind of acted like vampires because it was cool to be pale and weak. But then two, you know, a tuberculosis patient in the late stages, like, looks like a vampire, you know, and then they get buried and we don't know about germs. So all of a sudden it seems like, well, you know, your sick family member went away, but now we all feel bad. And it's like, well, yeah, you got infected. You got tuberculosis yourself now.
I don't think the name The Consumption really helped it on that fact either.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, no, no, no. He's coming back from the grave. He's draining me of my vitality. But no, yeah, that was all super interesting, and I did not know the thing about Saved by the Bell, even though I did know that there was that mechanism. I didn't know about the phrase. That's super cool.
All right, cool. We're done here, I think. Just, you know, a bunch of dead people talking about it, having a good time with it, you know. That's not true.
Having a good time.
Oh, such a good song.
Yeah. Okay.
Can we get that as our intro song? No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
like, royalties.
They gotta just be really cheap royalties, right? Like, well, oh, never mind, it is Queen.
Yeah, no. Okay, that's gonna do it for the first half of Brought to the Table today. Just before we head out for our break, I want to just ask everyone if you could take a minute and rate and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, Spotify, if we're up on there yet. We're working on it. There's a lot of podcast things. So yeah,
to be continued.
To be continued. Yeah. So we'll be up on as many podcast sites as we can. If we're not up on the one that you want, let us know. Just send us an email, and we'll do our best to get there. The one that I'm having trouble with right now is Spotify, not Spotify, SoundCloud. Thank you so much for listening. We're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll be back in a minute. All right, and we are back from the break. Thank you for sticking around during our little ditty there. So now we're going to have Scott and Caitlin talk to us a little bit about something that I don't understand, which is public key
You really don't understand.
Once it. More with feeling.
Which is public key cryptography.
All right, yeah, so public key cryptography. The first two and most important things I have to say about this is that data is imaginary and burritos are real.
Very important lesson.
Yep.
Okay, so first I think I will introduce what cryptography is, because I think a lot of people have heard the term or have heard terms that are related to it and are like, that's some black magic.
It helped me when you explained it yesterday, so.
So I'm going to describe kind of the general gist of cryptography. And the way I'm going to describe it is actually symmetric key cryptography, which is kind of not what we're talking about today. But I want you to picture you're in class, like you're in middle school again or something, and you want to pass a note to your friends that's like, I really have a crush on Bobby Sue, but you don't want anybody to read this message. So you've written it down on some pieces of paper, and you want to pass it to your friend, but you don't want the teacher to pick it up and read it aloud to the class, because that would like end your entire existence in middle school.
Then Bobby Sue would hear.
Exactly. So you have this clever scheme where you've written down this note. You can imagine just like all lowercase letters and maybe some spaces in there. And you number all of the letters, starting A is 1, B is 2, so on and so forth. So you have numbers between, say, like 1 and 27 if you say 27 as spaces. And now you add 3 to every number. And if it goes up above 27, you just roll it around. So like Z goes back around towards A. You could add 3 to every number. So A becomes D. You know, B becomes E, so on and so forth. Now, if you write the message out in those terms, you take the numbers and you put them back to letters, nobody would understand what you're saying, and it wouldn't say, I have a crush on Bobby Sue. It would say, blah, 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 blah. Now, your friend is like, oh, I got this garbage letter from my friend John here, and I'm going to turn it back into the real thing and figure out that he has a crush on Bobby Sue. So he just subtracts 3 from all of it, and then he reads the thing out. And that's all cryptography is. So the encryption is, I apply some garbage to my input, the message I want to send, that I know somebody can undo to read the actual message, but nobody in the middle can understand it.
That is basically symmetric key cryptography that Scott is talking about, something where add 3 and then subtract 3, something very simple that's basically the same on both sides. What we are talking about, public key cryptography, is in asymmetric key cryptography scheme. So each person has a public key and a private key, okay? And the classic example uses Alice and Bob as the names for some reason. So anyway, Bob wants to send a private message to Alice. So he says, hello, Alice, and then uses Alice's public key, which is freely available to everyone who cares to access it, you know, as the name suggests, public, it's readily available, to encrypt it. And then it's a bunch of garbage. And then Alice gets it, and she uses her private key to decrypt it so that she can read this message. And that works, you know, in a different way than just adding 3 and subtracting 3, because it's doing far more complicated math than humans do. So, you know, it's not actually the hardest thing in the world to multiply 2 very large numbers together. You know, many people can do that casually. But then if you try and take an obscenely large number and divide it back out, like through long division, like pen and paper, that's going to take you far longer than it took you to multiply it. I mean, you know, this is math for computers, so it's more complicated than just multiplying and dividing. But that's the basic scheme that helped me understand how your private key can be different than your public key, and how it's possible to encode something, how it's possible for everyone to encode something using the same public key, but then only the person who has the private key is able to decrypt it.
Yeah, and so like Caitlin was saying, like public key cryptography is kind of like solely focused around computers, or it's like very popular with computers. There was cryptography and stuff before computers even existed, when they needed to send messages back in the olden times. But public key cryptography is basically, we have designed algorithms that computers are good at doing in one direction that are very, very bad doing in the other direction. So most of the most common public key cryptography algorithm out now is RSA. It does a bunch of multiplication and discrete math in its actual algorithm. And It is theoretically possible, given a message in the public key, to derive the private key, which you would never want to do. Except to do that, you would need like infinitely large amounts of computing power. Like with the key sizes we use now, they've got like hundreds of digits and the numbers that they would be, you know, adding and subtracting in the example. Hundreds or thousands of digits, and you would need like basically the age of the universe times a million years to try and get one of these private keys out. Some unfeasibly large number.
So in terms of large-scale security, like Mongolia wants to find out the secrets of India, how good of a security system do you think public key cryptography is on a large in scale?
Well, so we're all sitting at computers right now, right? And we all probably have either the show notes or something open to a website. And if you're looking at a website that has HTTPS and that has, you know, that little green lock on it and it says secure, that's using public key cryptography. So it's super widely used and like very secure is my layman answer.
So to give a maybe different answer, public key cryptography is neither secure nor insecure. It's like a concept, just like cryptography. If you have the add three crypto for symmetric key, obviously not very secure because you could just like guess all the numbers and try them and see which one makes a real message out of it. The current implementations of public key cryptography, like if you were to break them in a way that's feasible, even with like billions of dollars of computer hardware, you would break the entire internet and basically everything.
Oh man.
So there are a lot of very smart people thinking about this right now, you can imagine.
Oh man.
Oh, yeah.
And so far, nobody's broken it. There are very theoretical things, but it's usually like, hey, we can make this 10x faster, so now it only takes like 4 quadrillion years instead of 40 quadrillion years.
So this really ties back into our first episode pretty well, because one of the key things that we talked about during quantum information technology was how it can affect public key cryptography and specifically RSA. So I don't know. I feel like it's just a nice touchstone back to that episode, really showing what that can do. You know, we've talked about how it relies heavily, or how it can destroy RSA if it was successfully completed.
And like the whole quantum computers beat RSA thing is like why quantum computers are even funded. And also, like, there are areas of research that are basically post-apocalyptic public key cryptography, because, like, we need this in the world. So there are, like, areas of research, and there are actually pretty practical algorithms now that are not known to be destroyed by quantum computers.
In the end of the world, we will be able to crack this code.
Or we'll be able to make
it. So I want to just, like, reiterate some of the points we went over so we can start going into applications in case you have lost. Public key cryptography is based on this notion that you can share something with somebody, your public key, they can use it to encrypt it, but only the person who has the private key can decrypt it. The asymmetry is the key part here, where you can do one step in the wide open and everybody knows what it is, but only that decryption step can be done with the private key.
Oh, the other example that I came across really commonly when I was looking this up was, imagine a key and a lock, and the lock has three positions, and it's locked, unlocked, and then locked again, you know, like east, north, west, locked, unlocked, etc. So you can unlock it in one direction, but then the keyhole is stuck in that direction, and you can't use the same key to unlock it again. You have to use the opposite key.
So basically, the public key moves it to the right, and then the private key can move it all the way to the right, to like the east or west position, depending. But yeah, public key can only move it one way, and the private key can move it the full way through. And so if you know somebody has moved it one way, you know which key they have. They've either moved it with the public key or they moved it with the private key. Caitlin, do you want to go over a list of some cool applications of this?
Sure. So like I said a second ago, just to illustrate how widespread it is, visiting any site with HTTPS in all of these, I think the S stands for secure. Maybe not quite. You know, that's really useful, especially for things like online banking applications, where that's actually very important for your privacy, and not your gossipy secrets about Bobby Sue and his ladies. Basically, doing anything online where you don't want other people, be it your roommates, people on your Wi-Fi, your Wi-Fi network, or the government, to know exactly what you're doing. You know, that's the sort of security that this can provide you. There's something else, SSH, which is used to operate remote computers or servers securely. And I bugged Scott about this yesterday, and he explained he works in Boston, but his company has a ton of computing in North Carolina. And almost every day he uses this to operate those computers that are, you know, hundreds, a thousand, many, many miles away. It's also used in end-to-end encrypting messaging apps that you might really commonly use, like WhatsApp or any of those other ones. I'm an old lady, so I just text. I don't know what the other ones are, but there's a lot. Oh, and it's also cool that you can use it to sign things. You can sign things with your private key, and then someone can look at that and know that it was you. And Scott, you did a better job of explaining this, especially with regards to like GitHub and stuff yesterday. So do you want to jump in?
Sure. So maybe we can go back to the lock analogy, even though it's not perfect. Like we said, we have this like public key that turns it one way and the private key that finishes it. You can imagine the reverse direction where somebody publishes their public key and you trust them. Like you've met them before and you're like, hey, this is my public key. And you've, you know, written it down. Then you can do the kind of whole process in reverse, where somebody takes a message and they garble it with their private key. And then if you apply their public key to ungarble it, you're like, oh, that definitely is the message. And I can trust that whoever garbled that message definitely did it with that private key.
Make sure you gargle all messages.
Ugh. I'm saying garble with a B.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Oh, I thought you were just garbling the word garble and it came out to gargle.
Nah, like, that's how you keep your messages secure. Goggles. You gotta gargle. Gargle each one.
Or we just do what we do and we just gobble them.
Yes.
So the whole signing thing is basically, it's one of the most important parts of public key cryptography, actually. Not necessarily the like encrypting messages part. So the ability to sign a message and have people know that it was you who signed it is extremely useful. This is actually the part of HTTPS that is used in public key cryptography. It's not actually the regular encryption of the messages. So this is used pretty widely for both like signing messages, but also that's a form of authentication. It's how I can know you are who you say you are. So imagine we have like a central place where we can all put our public keys that everybody trusts. I'm going to use an example that people who program are familiar with, but it's not super important. I have the subsite I use called GitHub. And I log in with a username and password like a regular website. Or I log in however you would imagine I want to log in. So GitHub trusts me. I trust GitHub. We've all done that dance. I can then post my public key on GitHub. Anybody can look at it. They trust GitHub because I trust GitHub. Everybody is like in some form of trust with GitHub about this is definitely my public key and it identifies with my username, Scott Pruitt or whatever. Then we can all use our private keys to sign things. Like I can... I could write some text and post it on my blog and then put a little garbled message that like I applied my private key to my text and I get out a message. And then if somebody didn't believe that I was the one who posted that, they could go unapply the garbling with my public key and be like, oh, well, I know this message was posted here and the only person who could have generated that garble is somebody with Scott's private key and I see Scott's public key, so I know that that's him. And this is exactly how HTTPS works for websites. When you connect to, say, google.com or bankofamerica.com, you don't want to be connecting to somebody, like, say you're in a Starbucks Wi-Fi network. You want to be connecting to somebody in that Starbucks who is, like, putting up, you know, bankofamerica.com and, like, forcing you to connect to it, and then you'll type in your password and everything would be bad. Your browser actually verifies, hey, that is definitely bankofamerica.com because I'm looking at some signature that I definitely trust, and nobody can forge it because of public key cryptography. And then it's also used pretty widely in other scenarios. Public key cryptography, as you may guess, is pretty complicated. And even though computers are really good at complicated math, they're better at math that is not this. So a lot of times you use public key cryptography to establish like, oh, you definitely are who you say you are. I'm definitely who I am, who I say I am. We've done some like message exchange and you use that to exchange the key for symmetric key, which is really fast for CPUs to churn out. So you can imagine we'd go through this whole protocol between me and my friend John. And then we would get that number 3 for my symmetric key cryptography. And then I could send him the note that I really like Bobby Sue. But if we're sending lots of notes, that would be a lot more efficient than doing this math over and over and over again.
So what drew you to this topic? Like, it seems like a very specific topic. Why do you guys find it so interesting?
I find it interesting because I actually worked a lot on network level security and stuff. And it's interesting that people, I think it's interesting that people don't even know that it's working for them, like, right now. Like, if you're Fair. Listening to this podcast, it's coming over HTTPS because I set up the hosting. So if you're listening to this, you're using public key cryptography in some way. It's probably not super important that this is encrypted data, but it's nice to know that at least, like, most of the things you're doing online that matter, like whenever you log in, if that person hasn't set up HTTPS, they're, like, either malicious or maliciously incompetent. So it's something that people are using every day, and I think in some place in your mind, you probably expect it to exist, right? Like, if you're doing banking online, even if you're in a Starbucks on an untrusted Wi-Fi network, you want that shit to work.
Yeah, and I agreed to do it because Scott brought it up. Like I mentioned before, I wanted to do a techie topic. I wanted to step outside my comfort zone, and I also wanted to see if, you know, this segment would still flow well with someone who isn't as techie. And also because I love, love, love XKCD, and as soon as I looked up what public key cryptography actually is, I was like, oh, I've read like 7 different XKCD comics centered around this and barely understood any of them. So it would be cool to learn more about this thing that's so widespread, widely used. But that I was just kind of willfully ignorant of before, because I'd definitely come across it a few times, but at no point was I like, yeah, I should figure out what those words mean.
Yeah. It's.
I was like, no, it's okay.
It's a part of so many systems that people take for granted. Like, symmetric key cryptography, great for things where you've already exchanged a key, but public key cryptography and systems like it are great for establishing trust over, like, the internet or places where you can't trust that you're not being snooped on by either Comcast or the NSA or whoever you think is the baddest person in the world right now. And it's kind of my thing with cryptography is it's like an interesting area of, like, really complicated math and super practical use cases. Does everybody understand the gist of it, or do you want more examples? Or
I believe I understand the gist, but I am sure that I do not.
We'll post some links that explain it better.
That was the hope of me also being here, is that we would break it down enough. But it's still a very strange thing, and I don't know, it might help to look at some visuals.
I think so. I got where you guys were going at it. I liked that you both had different approaches to the same topic.
Yes. It's not meant, like, the actual implementation of, like, a public key crypto algorithm is still, like, I've read over how RSA works, like, probably dozens of times now, and I still can't succinctly explain it to you. And trust that there are a bunch of really smart people in the crypto field, and public key cryptography is kind of relatively new. So.
Well, cool. Thanks for sharing with us.
Cool.
Is that all you guys have got? Sounds like it.
I'm done, unless people want to talk more about it, because I love this.
Yeah, that was basically it. We wanted to just focus on explaining it well and giving a few practical examples. We didn't want to
I think you crushed it. So, good job. High fives all around.
High fives
but
all
mostly
around.
Mostly for Scott and Caitlin, who just high-fived themselves to do some Foley work here. You? Okay.
Me.
All right. So that is going to do it for us here on Brought to the Table. You can find us on... Will you quit clapping, please?
Round of applause, everybody.
No.
Oh, yes, clapping. That was definitely clapping.
God damn it. I hate... That's a...
What? Instead of, like, furiously masturbating? Like...
I don't like this joke.
Where were you going with this
okay.
energy?
Thank you for listening to Brought to the Table. You can find us on Facebook, Tumblr, and the internet, just straight up the internet. We're Brought to the Table on all of those platforms, you know, and the internet as a whole being broughttothetable.com. You can email us at brought to the table at gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at To The Table Pod. It was a little too long to just, you know, put in Brought to the Table. So, To The Table Pod is where we're at. Unfortunate.
brought to the table foot.
Nope. And please leave a review, like, subscribe. Just let people know that we exist. You know, we're a pretty new podcast, and we're trying to get a foothold or whatever you want to call it. So just tell your friends. We'd appreciate that a lot. If you have submissions, which we desperately want, we would love to read them on the air. Send them to broughttothetable@gmail.com. That's, you know, I check that every day in hopes and dreams that we'll get one day. One day we might.
One day.
So please do that. I think, let me read over the notes, make sure I got everything. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Okay. Broughttothetable.com. Okay. Broughttothetable@gmail.com. Okay.
You're garbling.
I'm encrypting. I'm encrypting gargling. The message. This is part of our ARG.
Oh man.
Did you see?
Do we have the right clearance for this?
I do. Y'all don't. You're technically not allowed to hear my messages. Okay, we're leaving. Bye.
Bye.
Remember, bye. Data is imaginary and burritos are real.
Once in English class, we were talking about art and like the value of making art and experiencing art. And someone was like, well, you don't need to like justify your art. You can just make art for yourself. And then my, you know, elderly lady English teacher just looks over and she's like, no, that's masturbation.